Peter B. Collins News and Comment. Surprise! I'm here. It's Wednesday, June 7th, 2017, and it was only yesterday that I told you that my jury duty service would preclude me from hosting a podcast today. But after a morning session, the judge informed us that we were going to recess until tomorrow. So I rushed on over here to the secret studio, pulled together some news articles to comment on, and here we go. Well, I don't know that we can call this a leak, but James Comey's prepared statement for his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Thursday has been pre-released. Now, I don't know if this is the latest leak in a leaky beltway encampment there in Washington, but it is fascinating to get this advance pre-look at what Comey plans to say tomorrow. And it does add new information to what has been leaked so far by friends of James Comey about the way he kept notes on his meetings and phone calls with Trump and the growing sense of unease that he felt as Trump kept asking him for loyalty and explicitly asked him to drop the investigation into the resigned and disgraced former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn. Now, before I run through the comments that Comey is expected to deliver, I have to say that it's an eye-opener for both sides, because there is new information here and a pattern surfaces about what Trump was angling for. But what also surfaces is that Jim Comey should have gone public, should have protested, or he should have resigned his position after he fielded the third or fourth inappropriate request from the president. And this is going to come up. I believe that the Republicans are going to pepper him. I've heard the preview from Sean Hannity on his radio show in recent days, where he says, look, Comey was up there on May 3rd, and he said that no one had tried to interfere with his investigations. And how Comey is going to square these 2 points will be very interesting. Now, he is a deft fellow. He's very comfortable in front of the cameras and opposite the senators. He knows how to duck a question when he wants to or needs to. And while his range of options to avoid answering a question may have been limited because he's no longer in office, he can dodge it by saying, well, you know, Bob Mueller, my predecessor at the FBI and now the straight shooter who's conducting the investigation as special counsel, I just don't want to trip over his work. And you can expect that will be a frequent response, I believe, from Mr. Comey. So in his statement, he says that he first met with Trump before the inauguration, Friday, January 6th, he went there with the other members of the intelligence community to brief the president on the Russia allegations and also about the so-called dossier from the British former intelligence officer who was doing this as opposition research. We still don't know who was paying him, but probably somebody close to Hillary Clinton. So Comey's statement reads, the director of national intelligence asked that I personally do this portion of the briefing because I was staying in my position. Of course, he would be moving on. He's a political appointee. And because the material implicated the FBI's counterintelligence responsibilities. We also agreed I would do it alone to minimize potential embarrassment to the president-elect. You know, about the golden showers and the other efforts to compromise Trump. A little later in the statement, Comey will say, when the FBI develops reason to believe an American has been targeted for recruitment by a foreign power or is covertly acting as an agent of the foreign power, the FBI will open an investigation on that American and use legal authorities to try to learn more about the nature of any relationship with the foreign power. In that context, prior to the January 6 meeting, I discussed with the FBI's leadership team whether I should be prepared to assure President-elect Trump that we were not investigating him personally. That was true. We did not have an open counterintelligence case on him. We agreed I should do so if circumstances warranted. Now, this is one of the three assurances that Trump cited in his memo firing Jim Comey. It stood out as such a bizarre thing to be included in what is usually a very terse termination notice. So then he says how he started his process, his practice of taking notes on all this. I felt compelled to document my first conversation with the president-elect in a memo. To ensure accuracy, I began to type it on a laptop in an FBI vehicle outside Trump Tower the moment I walked out of the meeting. Creating written records immediately after one-on-one conversations with Trump was my practice from that point forward. It had not been my practice in the past, so he's anticipating that question from Republicans. I spoke alone with President Obama twice, never on the phone. Once in 2015 to discuss law enforcement policy issues, and a second time briefly to say goodbye to him in late 2016. In neither of these circumstances did I memorialize the discussions. And then he says he had 9 one-on-one conversations with Trump in 4 months, 3 in person, 6 on the phone. Then he goes to the dinner that we've heard about, but we get more details. January 27th, Trump called Comey at lunchtime that day and invited him to dinner that night, saying he had planned to invite the whole family, but decided just to have me this time. What? Anyway, it was just the two of them. The president began by asking whether I wanted to stay on as FBI director, which I found strange because he had already told me twice in earlier conversation he hoped I would stay. He said lots of people wanted my job. And let's see, he said, my instincts told me the dinner was at least in part an effort to have me ask for my job and create some sort of patronage relationship. That concerned me greatly, he said. And then he said the setup there started to make him uneasy, the setup of the next point. He said that Comey said he loved his work and intended to stay, but Trump had asked for his loyalty. And so he said, I am not reliable in the way politicians use that word, but you can always count on me to tell the truth. A few moments later, the president returned to the point, said, I need loyalty. I expect loyalty. And Comey says, I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way. He went all mime on us. During the awkward silence that followed, we simply looked at each other in silence. The conversation then moved on. And he returned to the subject at the end of the dinner when he said he was very glad I wanted to stay on, adding that he had heard great things about me from other people. I need loyalty, he said. Comey replied, he says, you will always get honesty from me. He paused and said, that's what I want, honest loyalty. I paused and then said, you will get that from me. As I wrote in the memo I created immediately after, it is possible we understood the phrase honest loyalty differently, but I decided it wouldn't be productive to push it further. Now, to me, this is the point where Comey should have sent up a signal flare and said, the president has talked to me in an inappropriate manner. But he sucked it up and kept going. Then there was a meeting with a group of people on Valentine's Day, the same day or the day after they had fired Mike Flynn. And at the end of the meeting, the president asked everybody else to leave, including Attorney General Sessions and Jared Kushner. And he said to Comey, I want to talk about Mike Flynn. Flynn had resigned the day before. And the president began by saying Flynn hadn't done anything wrong in speaking with the Russians, but he had to let him go because he had misled the vice president and added that he had other concerns but didn't specify. Then he returned to the topic of Flynn a little bit later. He's a good guy. He's been through a lot. And this is where he said, and these words matter. He did not order or instruct Comey to do anything. He said, I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go. I hope you can let this go. And Comey says, I replied only that he is a good guy. Now, this is not an episode of great courage on the part of Comey. He's being diplomatic. He's avoiding a confrontation with a madman. But he's not standing his ground as the director of the independent FBI. And so he made another memo about that encounter. Then there was the March 30th phone call. And this one was new to me. The president called Comey at the FBI, and Comey doesn't explain why he took the call after all of these inappropriate contacts. Trump said he had nothing to do with Russia, hadn't been involved with hookers in Russia, and had always assumed he was being recorded when in Russia. He asked what we could do to lift the cloud. I responded we were investigating as quickly as we could, that there would be great benefit if we didn't find anything to our having done the work well. He agreed, but then reemphasized the problems and then pressured him to get the fact out that, once again, this was the third time Comey assured him that Trump personally was not the subject of investigation as of March 30th. Then there was a phone call on April 11th. The president called me and asked what I had done about his request that I get out that he's not personally under investigation. Again, I ask, why did Comey take that call? He doesn't pick up his own line. The way that works is a secretary from the White House calls and says the president's on the line, and the secretary to the director of the FBI says, okay, I'll get him. Or he's unavailable. He's on a plane. He's in the loo. I mean, so this, I think, is going to be central. Because Comey has very damaging information here about Trump. There is no question about it. It is compromising to the integrity of the president, and it does form the basis for claims of obstruction of justice. But will Comey survive the challenges to his integrity caused by his failure to act until he got fired? And so I think there's going to be a very interesting exchange. Fortunately, the court is not going to be in session until late enough that I should get to watch on the time shift here on the West Coast the first couple of hours of Comey's testimony, and it will be interesting. Again, based on the court schedule for my jury duty, I'm not sure when my next podcast will be. It might be on Friday, but that is unclear at this point. And we do know that the president's schedule is pretty clear tomorrow morning, so that he can grab his phone and tweet back his rejoinders to statements made by Comey. This is going to be one of the most bizarre events on Capitol Hill in my lifetime. It really is. And at the White House, they were going to try to set up a war room, but nobody could decide whether it should be on the premises or outside, who should man it, who could be trusted, what the talking points might be. And so they've decided to reduce it to Trump's Twitter account and an effort to smear Jim Comey. They are preparing a campaign-style line of attack aimed at undercutting Comey's reputation. They plan to portray him as a showboat and to bring up past controversies about his career. And maybe they will micro-target that to Trump supporters using the information from Cambridge Analytica that we talked about yesterday. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill today, I've got this photo in front of me right now. It's from The Guardian. And it shows the acting director of the FBI, McCabe, the deputy attorney general, Rosenstein, the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, and the NSA director, Mike Rogers. And they're all sitting there stone-faced as they stonewall. Because it was published in the Washington Post, based on a leak, of course, last night, that Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, has told his associates that he has had inappropriate pressure from Trump to go public and defend the president on the Russia investigation. We're also told that Mike Rogers was approached that way and rebuffed the president. But when they were asked by members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, they either had non-answers or they simply refused to answer. Dan Coats, a former senator from Indiana, who's there with his colleagues, he dodged the question by saying he never felt pressured to shape intelligence in a political way. But when pressed on his communications with Trump and the question of whether the president had asked him to step in to influence the investigation, he said he would not respond in a public hearing, saying it was not an appropriate venue. Now, this is bullshit. Dan Coats knows it, and so do all of his Senate and former colleagues right there. Rogers said, I'm not going to discuss the specifics of any interactions or conversations that I may or may not have had with the President of the United States. And then his non-denial, in the 3+ years that I've been director of NSA, to the best of my recollection, I have never been directed to do anything I believe to be illegal, immoral, or unethical. Now that doesn't square with the leaks. It doesn't square with the way Trump, we know, has treated Comey, and we believe has treated Coates. McCabe, FBI acting director, said he used the Mueller dodge. He didn't want to step into the lane of the special counsel, and so he refused to answer the question. Now, Angus King, the independent senator from Maine, who occasionally gets his back up, he was pissed. He pressed McCabe on why he wouldn't comment. McCabe said he couldn't discuss anything within the purview of the Justice Department investigation being run by Mueller. King, why does the special counsel get preference and not this committee? Well, this is one of the problems that comes from these parallel investigations, and I mentioned this as many people celebrated the appointment of the special counsel. I also have serious doubts that Bob Mueller will produce more than a whitewash and do more than really protect his old turf at the FBI. Anyway, King then turned to Coates and Rogers, who refused to answer in detail questions about Trump and his effort to influence them. And Coates struggled to respond. Now, the last time he was asked about this, there was a 9-second pause. Rachel Maddow has played the pause repeatedly and timed it for us, so we know. And he, you know, then just dodged the question and said, oh, I'd like to avoid that question or something like that. Anyway, Coates struggled again today, and King pressed him. Senator King, you swore that oath to tell us the truth, demanding the legal basis for Coates' decision not to comment. And Coates was remarkably honest. He said, I'm not sure I have a legal basis, but he's willing to discuss it in a closed-door session. Now, the other thing that came up is the Republican side of this is they want to investigate the alleged unmasking of Americans who are caught up in intercepted conversations with Russians or others, and in particular those that might have been unmasked by members of the Obama administration in their final month or two in office. I do believe this is a legitimate area of inquiry, but I believe that the Republicans use it as a diversion from their obvious liabilities. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Terry Paris, she's got more than one. Tom Burkhart just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, Tom. And there's Terry Paris again as I flip the page here. Cheryl Fleming, Michael Petty just renewed his annual subscription. Thanks to each of you for your support. And I want to invite others who haven't stepped up. It's your turn. If you've got a little extra money in the bank, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, click on become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and boom, in a couple of minutes, you can pick a subscription level that is comfortable for you. And today, once again via Twitter, Trump announced his intention to appoint Christopher A. Wray, W-R-A-Y, to be the next director of the FBI, succeeding Comey and before that Mueller. And he is a Republican who served as a U.S. attorney. He also was in the Justice Department and tried to share in the heroic moment when Mueller and Comey refused to bend to White House demands. This was, what, back in 2004, Comey, who was then the acting attorney general because John Ashcroft was hospitalized, Comey and Mueller did prevent the effort to force Ashcroft to sign the document, and the White House did back down. It was such a narrow part of the surveillance program that this is hardly a profile in courage. But this guy, Ray, was working as the chief criminal prosecutor at the Justice Department, and he apparently offered to join that effort, but it never actually happened. Well, the most recent credential that Chris Ray has is that as a corporate attorney in a law firm, He represented Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor, in the Bridgegate scandal. And, of course, Christie came out unscathed. A couple of his cronies are going to prison. Christie lied like mad. And Mr. Ray, using the attorney-client privilege, was able to prevent him from being prosecuted for perjury. But Ray has been a checkbook writer to Republicans, except for Trump. He made no contributions in 2016, but he did make the minimum maximum contribution to John McCain and to Mitt Romney in 08 and 12, respectively. So we'll hear more about this as they gear up for confirmation hearings. The only good thing I can say about from what I know so far is that Ray was the successful prosecutor of the Uber lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And that Uber is the German word. That's before the ride-sharing scam surfaced. There was a stunning attack in Tehran today. And this appears to be related to Trump's meddling in the Middle East and the efforts to marginalize Qatar from the Gulf Cooperation Council and the general alliance of the Sunni dictators in the Middle East. And the attack in Iran, which is claimed by the Islamic State, but we don't have evidence of that, was quite brazen. One team of people attacked the parliament building. At least 12 people are dead, 42 wounded. There were six at least attackers. One was female. They're all dead as well. But this was a real eye-opener, and Iran is blaming the United States and the Saudis. And that appears to be a fair targeting from my perspective. And after many hours, the State Department finally issued a kind of rote statement. The U.S. condemns the terrorist attacks in Tehran today, express our condolences. The depravity of terrorism has no place in a peaceful, civilized world. But the Iranians believe that this is a scene that was hatched by Trump and the Saudis. And, of course, Egypt was represented. So were some of the other emirates. When Trump visited Saudi Arabia now almost 2 weeks ago. And so we, at this point, have too little information to go on. But it does seem that there is a scheme to isolate Qatar, despite the fact that it's a huge American ally and has a critical military base where our central command operates from. And today, consider the source, but the FBI has announced that Russian hackers, and they hasten to add that these are not government hackers, they're just hackers who happen to be in the nation of Russia, are reportedly responsible for sending out fake news attributed to the Qatari government that has sparked this diplomatic crisis. It is believed that the Russian government was not involved. Now, that voice is the omniscient voice of an official leaker. And it is the kind of assessment that this whole Russia scandal has been riddled with. It is believed. So somebody is assessing with confidence here, friends, which means that it may or may not be true. At any rate, I'll read this whole thing. It is believed that the Russian government was not involved in the hacks. Instead, freelance hackers were paid to undertake the work on behalf of some other state or individual. Some observers have claimed privately that Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates may have commissioned the hackers. And one of the reasons is that after the fake news story, which claimed that the Emir of Qatar was taking the side of Iran and, let's see, what else did they do? I can't quite remember what the other charge is, but here it is. Qatar claims the hacking operation was designed to discredit the Emir of Qatar by attributing to him remarks in support of Iran and critical of Donald Trump. It is pointed out that the fake news stories, which were a product of the hack, were quickly picked up by Saudi and United Arab Emirates news agencies. And one of their targets is Al Jazeera, the news agency that is paid for and originates in Qatar. And the other demands are to roll back support for the Islamic Brotherhood and Hamas. And they want Al Jazeera to be shut down. So this is not about Syria. And Trump's false tweet, kind of tweaking the Qataris, suggested that this could be the beginning of the end of terrorism. And that's just bullshit, and it just shows his ignorance and how easily he can be manipulated. But this is a situation to watch because we know that Trump and the Republicans are eager for war with Iran. And this could easily become the basis, the casus belli, for such a mistake. Trump went to Cincinnati. You may know that's where I was born and grew up. It's a reliable Republican stronghold, and that's one of the reasons why I left. At any rate, he was supposed to be talking about his effort to rebuild infrastructure, but he started off by talking about tearing down Obamacare. And it's fair to say the Republicans are running a demolition derby. And if that reference is lost on you, in stock car racing and at local tracks around the country, there are occasionally these figure-eight races where the drivers get in old beat-up cars and destroy them. It's called a demolition derby. And that's what it appears Trump and the Republicans are trying to do with Obamacare, because they only got repeal through the House. It stalled in the Senate. They don't have a clue about what to replace it with. And yet the White House is simply doing everything it can to erode the law, to undermine it, to spook the insurance companies, to really cause the public to go south on it. And this is properly being called sabotage by Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. One example, all right? 2 weeks ago, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina filed a rate increase of almost 23%. And they said that it would have only been under 9% if the administration had a solid plan going forward and was committed to paying the cost-sharing subsidies that are really the crucial part of making Obamacare affordable for certain people. And different agencies like Health and Human Services either spread misinformation or they send out gleeful press releases when another insurance company says, we're not going to provide coverage in a given state next year. And so, one way or the other, they are going to destroy Obamacare, and millions of people are going to be left without coverage. And many people will buy crappy coverage for less money, only to find out that it really won't help them when they get a serious illness and, in particular, some sort of lengthy hospitalization. Well, there's widespread condemnation of The Intercept, and two of its reporters are being singled out for criticism in the way they bungled the leak from former NSA contractor Reality Winner. And we're learning more about this 25-year-old woman. She was a yoga teacher. That talks to me. I'm a yogi. And there's still many things that don't make sense. But the New York Times has examined the episode and says that the reporters at The Intercept may have, hopefully it was inadvertently, but they may have helped lead the government to their source. And at The Intercept, they're claiming they didn't know who she was. But the way they handled the document that she provided made it easy for the government to find the micro dots, a crease in it, figure out who had copied the document, only six people. I mean, they keep track of all this stuff. And so she was extremely naive, but she was also led down a path, or at least permitted to go down a path by the reporters at The Intercept that has left her as a sacrificial lamb. And as I pointed out yesterday, the stuff she revealed isn't worth it. This is no Ed Snowden package of revelations. Now, my friend Peter Van Buren at his site We Meant Well takes a little more tongue-in-cheek approach, but Peter's sense of humor belies his very sharp analytical skills. His headline reads, "Hey Intercept, something is very wrong with Reality Winner and the NSA leak." And he starts with the professional analysis. He asks the Latin question, qui bono, who benefits? And he has a few bullet points here. Trump looks bad as another trickle of information comes out connecting something Russian to something 2016 election. Intelligence community looks like they're onto something a day or so before Comey testifies before Congress on related matters. The Intercept looks like it contributed to burning a source. Which potential leaker is going to them in the future? If potential leakers are made to think twice, another win for the intelligence community. Next point, the FBI made an arrest right away, nearly simultaneous to the publication, with the formal charges coming barely an hour after The Intercept published. The bust is sure thing, according to the very publicly released information. No Ed Snowden hiding out in Russia this time. Intelligence community looks good here. More evidence is now in the public domain that the Russians are after our election process. Seems as if the IC has been right all along. Now, there I disagree with Van Buren, because this really didn't show any pervasive effort to hack. It shows a spear phishing attempt that actually, you know, connected with a voting software company in Florida. But that may not have been intentional. It may have been just one of many targets in many different categories. And we know the bottom line is that their hack didn't do anything. But let's return to his analysis. What happened is curiouser and curiouser, is the subhead. A 25-year-old improbably named reality winner leaves behind a trail long and wide on social media of anti-Trump stuff, including proclaiming herself a member of the resistance. Never mind, she takes her top-secret clearance with her out of the Air Force, and she had been at Fort Meade, and scores a job with an NSA contractor. Despite the lessons of too much access the Snowden episode should have taught the NSA, Winner apparently enjoys all sorts of classified documents. Her Air Force expertise was Afghan matters, so it is unclear why she would have access to info on Russia hacking of U.S. domestic companies. Within only about 90 days of starting her new job, she prints out the one and only, apparently, why not more, document in question and mails it to The Intercept. She also uses her work computer inside an NSA facility to write to The Intercept twice at about this same time. And here he goes into a bit of a lecture mode. Winner has a clearance. She was trained as a language specialist by the Air Force. She knows how classified stuff works. She's been told repeatedly, as all persons with a clearance are, that her computer, email, printing, and phone are monitored. She mailed the document from Augusta, Georgia, the city where she lives and where the NSA facility is located. She practiced no tradecraft, did nothing to hide her actions, and many things to call attention to them. It is very, very unclear why she took the actions she did under those circumstances. Then he turns to The Intercept. He says it drops by their friendly NSA neighborhood contact and shows them the document. But funny thing, while the leaked document seems to be a big deal, at least to the general public, it sort of isn't. It shows one piece of analysis suggesting, but not confirming, that the GRU, the Russian military intelligence, tried to steal some credentials and gain access to a private company. No U.S. sources and methods or raw technical intel are revealed. There is no evidence the hack accomplished anything at all, never mind anything nefarious. And finally, the commentary of Kevin Gostola at Shadowproof. And he notes that Winner is being charged under the Espionage Act, even though she's not being accused of any kind of espionage. It is more properly a failure to honor her security agreement. And that is a fairly cut-and-dried matter that doesn't take into account her intent or anything else. And so this use of the Espionage Act is copycat of Obama, and it shows another bad precedent that follows from the Obama administration. But the most important part of what Gostola writes about are the two Intercept reporters, Richard Esposito and Matthew Cole. They were both at the center of the leaked prosecution against CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou, and they were named there as Journalist A and Journalist B. And he goes through the details of the Kiriakou prosecution. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast so that you can get those details yourselves. But Kiriakou was definitely burned by Matt Cole. And so it appears was Reality Winner. I think that's two strikes, and that's enough to say, Matt Cole, maybe you should stop writing journalism and go write some press releases for a PR firm. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. It's available on YouTube, and I'll be back whenever jury duty permits. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.